Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Back before Donald Trump turned homelessness into a weird political hot button, I had wanted to do an episode on this with a real expert. So I got in touch with Mary Cunningham from the Urban Institute. Then Trump did his thing. Mary came down. We had a really great conversation, not so much focused on the politics and the antics, but on what we really know about homelessness and what we can do to help. If you love housing, as I do, this is a really great discussion of one of the most serious problems we face. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today is Mary Cunningham. She's a senior fellow and vice president at the Metropolitan Housing Community Center at the Urban Institute. That's a lot of words. For our purposes, Mary is really knowledgeable about homelessness and homelessness policy, a subject which, when I originally scheduled this, I had intended to be off the news, thing that I just happen to think is important and interesting. President Trump has sort of brought it into the news.
That's right.
With a report, but not to get too into the weeds, because he says things that don't make sense all the time. I think that, like, my broad impression as a person who's interested in housing, not that knowledgeable about homelessness, is that this is a situation that had been getting better for a while, that I used to always hear from progressive people like positive things about the Bush administration on homelessness and that good results had continued under Obama. But now it seems like people are upset again. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that is right. Just to take a look at the numbers. There are about 550,000 people who experience homelessness on any given night here in America. That number has been going down about 15% in the last decade. And that is largely because of real big shifts in practice and policy. And that work started with the Bush administration. There was a lot of research that showed that not only do we have a solution, and that is supportive housing, but also that there was a small number of people who were taking up a lot of the resources in the homeless world, and that is chronically homeless people. So people who had been homeless for really long periods and repeatedly often have a disability, they were using a lot of the homeless resources. And not only using a lot of the homeless resources, but also moving in and out of jails, costing a lot of money with policing, moving in and out of detox hospitals. And so some advocates took that evidence to the Bush administration and showed that not only is there this sort of really well-defined group that made up about 10 to 15% of the homeless population, but there is also a solution, and that solution was cost effective.
Okay.
And I think that really resonated with the Bush administration. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, okay. So let's break down some of this jargon, because
sure.
I think it's suggestive, right? So a phrase you used, right, is people experience homelessness, mm-hmm. right? Which in part, this is like, I think, progressives trying to use, be conscious of their language. But you also draw a distinction that there are some people who are chronically homelessness, and then there are other people who on any given day mm-hmm. may be not in a home. And these are sort of distinct. Obviously, there's a link, but these are distinct sorts of phenomena that can happen to people.
Yeah. I mean, I think we try to use people first language, you know, really want to describe homelessness as a condition or an experience, not as a group of people, because we know for the most part that people move in and out of homelessness. Mm-hmm. It's not the homeless. It's people moving in and out of that experience. And some people may experience homelessness once due to an economic crisis. They can't pay their rent. They miss the rent bill. They get evicted. Maybe they have some health conditions. Maybe they lost their job or they're going through a divorce and they experience homelessness. That's, you know, for the most part, most of the people who experience homelessness are experiencing homelessness because of economic reasons.
And so even though the number of people experiencing homelessness does not change that much from year, I mean, it changes, but it's similar. It's not the same people.
That's right. I mean, there's a small group of people, people who experience chronic homelessness or chronically homeless people, who really are experiencing it over the long term for more than a year or repeatedly. They're moving back in and out of homelessness. They're cycling in and out of jail. And they usually have disability, serious mental illness, often co-occurring substance use disorders that make it really difficult for them to maintain housing. But we know from the research that it's not impossible. And that's what I think the Bush administration really figured out. And, you know, during the 80s, during the 90s in New York City, for example, there was a lot of work to help get people off the street who are experiencing long-term homelessness into housing or really into shelter. But at that time, there were a lot of hoops that you had to jump through or very high barriers that you had to pass. So you had to be sober. You had to have it, you know, be engaging in services and agree to service requirements. And basically, that didn't work.
So that thinking was, okay, we are willing to provide shelter to people, but we want you to show that this is like a, you know, this is like a deserving, undeserving, poor distinction that comes up all the time on this show. So the idea was to say, look, we can give you a place to stay, but you need to show us that you have done all these things.
X, Y, Z, yep.
To like, you know, get off drugs, not be drinking. If you can't find a job, you have to do some kind of workfare type thing. And then we will say, okay, you are good enough to qualify for this. And in theory, that could have just like inspired everybody to get clean and sober. But in practice, no.
It didn't, right? In practice, it didn't work. And, you know, that was sort of what's known as housing readiness. Mm-hmm. And there was a clinical psychologist named Samson Barris who in the 90s in New York City decided, hey, this isn't working. This housing readiness isn't working. I'm trying to get people to come into shelter. I'm offering something they, A, don't want. And so I'm going to try something totally different and started offering people an apartment with no conditions, saying, hey, come into housing. You don't have to get sober. You don't have to agree to any preconditions around service requirements. Just come in and then we will help you stabilize and we'll provide you supportive services voluntarily. And that showed really amazing results in terms of really high rates of housing stability and also just housing people that generally people thought were unhousable. And I think that's that sort of revolutionized the way we think about how to approach homelessness. It's called housing first. That's what the Bush administration really invested in. Said, we're going to end chronic homelessness. We're going to invest in supportive housing and housing first. And then the numbers started going down.
Right. And so what I think impressed people, particularly a Republican administration about this, is that as I understand it sounds a little perverse, like, yeah, just give them a house. But it turns out that this is relatively inexpensive compared to sort of doing all the policing and other things that were happening with people chronically on the street.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it still costs money,
right,
for sure. But compared to some of the, it costs a lot to do nothing, right? So if you don't do anything, people are still using costly public services. They have heavy policing costs. They are moving in and out of jail, hospitals, detox. These are costly emergency services. And so what some research showed done by colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania showed that basically this can be cost neutral. And I think that's what really resonated with the Bush administration.
Right. I mean, mean, you know, I mean, I think like a simple example is, you know, if you have people in the Northeast and Midwest, it gets very cold in the winter, mm-hmm. right? If people don't have a place to stay a certain number of the time, like they're going to be hypothermia, they're going to be in the emergency room all year round. It's a unhealthful way to be living. So you're going to be sick more. You're going to be using more medical services. And the preventative impacts of giving people a place to sleep, right, can be powerful. Even though it costs money to get them an apartment, it also costs money to do everything else.
That's right. And not only are people sick more because of exposure to living outside, but people are also using those systems mm-hmm. as housing. I was just in Alaska and Anchorage, and there's a very large visible homeless population there. And I was talking to service providers, and they were saying, you know, people are pretty resourceful, and they're, you know, thinking about how do I get into the hospital? How mm-hmm. do I get into the jail? Because that's actually becomes the de facto housing for people who are really vulnerable.
Right. And so if you make it easier for people to sort of say yes to assistance on the basics of housing, then they do it. And then you can try to meet them, like literally meet them where they are.
That's right.
With addiction, you know, services, whatever else.
That's right. Engage them voluntarily and really provide them something that they need and want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this helped start bringing down homelessness numbers starting when?
I would say in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. And basically the actual data that we have really first available mm-hmm. was 2007, and then you see numbers, so late 2000s,
right.
Then you see the numbers going down slowly. I think the other big investment, and this continued with the Obama administration, was really a focus on veterans, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's very hard to say we don't want to have a commitment to veterans, right? We want to really follow through on our obligations. And there was this general recognition that we have a lot of homeless veterans. And so the Obama administration and Congress really mm-hmm. doubled down and made huge investments in supportive housing and homelessness prevention and rapid rehousing. And then you also see a very similar trajectory, which is as you make those housing-based investments, homelessness among veterans goes down. And homelessness among veterans is cut almost in half during that decade.
Are veterans actually unusually likely to be homeless, or is it just that this is a population that has a sort of distinct service delivery mechanism and maybe a, you know, easier politics behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's probably a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, it's tricky because there's obviously a selection of who goes into the military.
Sure.
So who may be vulnerable coming out, there's a little bit of selection bias there. Mm-hmm. I also think that there's a political support for
sure.
veterans. Like, who wants to be against veterans? I don't.
I've recommended this book before, but Theda Scotchwell's book, Protecting Soldiers and Mothers, mm-hmm. about the sort of political and social origins of the American welfare state, you know, is very clear on this, right? That it's always that veterans is always a population for whom mobilizing political support for social services is a little bit easier
yeah.
than other people.
That's right. And there is a whole social service delivery system as well through the VA, through medical benefits, homeless services. I think that there's also an opportunity here, which is to say that the work on veterans is a little bit of a proof point, which mm-hmm. is if you invest in housing, then you can see the numbers of homelessness going down.
Right. So now, is homelessness in fact on the rise, or is this just something President Trump like picked up randomly because he went to California one day?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. As I mentioned, there are about 550,000 homeless people on any given night. The numbers were going down. In the last couple of years, they started to tick up. And that uptick has been in the unsheltered population. Mm-hmm. So people who are highly visible. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, really drives the point home for people. As you see tents, as you see people living on the sidewalks, it just becomes it's a more publicly visible problem than it really has been, I think, since the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in Washington, you can see people under the K Street Bridge all around, and it's just more visible problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's also my, you know, this is the kind of thing, like, you know, this is not data, but I've lived here since 2003, mm-hmm. and I started coming here a few years earlier than that, and my impression is that I see more tents, more, more people on the streets than I did 10 years ago, but that it reminds me of what I saw when I visited when I was in college in the early 2000s. But of course, that's an important distinction, right? Sheltered versus unsheltered, because, people, I think, would probably rather have like a permanent place to live. For the mass public, though, it's like what you see matters a lot. And so what is driving this? I mean, the folk wisdom, at least when I was being raised by liberals in New York in the 80s, was that we were seeing more people on the streets because of disinvestment in mental health services and deinstitutionalization. Is there something that's like happened now that has this driving back up?
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly think that the supports in the safety net and mental health system are really important and an important part of the puzzle. But generally speaking, homelessness is fundamentally a housing problem, mm-hmm. and more specifically, a lack of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a housing market that doesn't produce enough housing units for the poorest among us, and probably never will, because it doesn't make economic sense for housing developers. It just doesn't pencil out when you look at the numbers. And so in order to make sure that we don't have homelessness, that we don't have a lot of housing insecurity, we really need government intervention, and that is in the form of housing assistance, housing subsidies, housing vouchers.
Right. But I mean, but that's sort of what puzzles me about it, because we have not fully and adequately funded housing vouchers like forever. Right. So if you go back to 2014, I've written pieces like we should do more about this. Housing production. It seems to me that hasn't fundamentally changed in the past couple of years. So, like, what accounts for the delta here?
Yeah, I think that's right. This is a long-term crisis. I'm using air quotes here, right? It's been, long time disinvestment in our housing, our affordable housing. I think what you're seeing here is there are some communities that are making progress, actually, mm-hmm. where the numbers are going down.
Okay.
And then there are some places where the numbers are going up, mm-hmm. like DC and, a lot of big cities, and they're really struggling. And so there's sort of this balancing where it looks like the national numbers aren't really changing much. There's places where it's going down. There's places where it's going up. Those are usually very high-cost markets. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's happening.
Right, that makes sense. Okay, so let's take a break, and then I want to start talking about some of those high-cost markets.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So I was recently in Seattle, where they have seen, I think, a large increase in unsheltered homelessness. And something people say there and that people tell me every time I go to the West Coast is that the problem is that these cities have mild climates and sort of liberal politics. And so they act as a sort of a magnet that, you know, if you are going to be forced to live on the streets, you would rather do that in Los Angeles or I don't know. Well, you'd rather do it in Seattle than in Chicago, right, is sort of what the theory comes down to. Is there anything to that?
I hear that theory all the time. People say to me, if I were homeless, I would move to Florida or I would move to California. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the data really bear that out. I mean, I do think there is some mobility, right? It's mm-hmm. normal mobility that people do move around. And people do seek services, and there may be places where there are more that are more rich in services, where maybe living on the street is a little bit more tolerable. But like, take, for example, San Francisco. Most of the people who experience homelessness actually grew up in, you know, in the San Francisco area. And the data shows that when the city does their annual point in time data, they actually ask people, where did you first experience homelessness? And a majority of the folks are saying here. So I don't think the data really bear that out.
Right. So the other theory is that what's happening is that a lot of people are moving to Seattle and San Francisco and Los Angeles because those are nice places to live. Not people experiencing homelessness, but people getting jobs in the thriving, growing economies, and that this is making houses there more expensive.
Yes,
and
I subscribe to that theory.
Right. This is the correct theory. Mm-hmm. But what this means, like, it's generally like good, right? Like, if you go to Seattle, there's a lot of stuff there. A lot of people have come there. Its wages are relatively high, but housing costs are also high. And so if you happen to not have gotten a highly paid job at Microsoft or Amazon, you now have a problem.
That's right. I mean, I think those cities that are, you know, have booming economies need to really think intentionally about how to share that prosperity mm-hmm. across all of the people who are living there. And, you know, part of that is having comprehensive affordable housing plans.
Right.
And really being intentional and investing in housing. But the challenge is that in places up and down the West Coast and really across the country, mm-hmm. we just have not invested in affordable housing for a really long time. There's been demand and supply has not kept up with the demand. And so, you know, to catch up is really difficult.
Right. And this is why I think people find it like micro-paradoxical that you have these problems intensify among prosperity, but it's like actually quite directly linked, right? It's like when an economy does well, average wages go up, average prices of land go up, but some people fall below that average line. And unless you do things to like make sure that you are building stuff and giving money to the people who need it, like this is what's going to happen.
That's right.
And you know, one of the things that you see is often people look. It seems to me that there's a tendency in these cities to look a lot at like percentages. So they'll say like, well, this is good. Like we got this project and it was 20% subsidized or something. But you also have to look at just like quantities, right? Like it doesn't – if you have like one building and it's 20% subsidized housing, like that doesn't help people. Like you need a lot. Like what kind of magnitudes are we talking about?
Pretty big, actually. So yeah. California, to close the gap on affordability, it's 1.4 million units. There is a long way to go. And, you know, not only does it take time to build and mm-hmm. produce affordable housing, so you may need some housing subsidies where people can take their housing subsidy, they can move around the private market mm-hmm. and they can rent from a land landlord. You've got to make sure those landlords are accepting housing vouchers. I could talk more about some of the challenges there.
Yeah.
But you also need to be producing units and preserving units. So there's a recent report from Harvard that just was released about what naturally occurring affordable units. And so there's always a small share of your sort of aging stock that's affordable. You want to make sure that that is not going offline and that's staying affordable. So you have to be doing all of it. You have to be producing, preserving, and also protecting tenant rights.
Right.
And so it's an all of above situation. And I think the challenge that we haven't really worked through and that we need a better playbook on is really NIMBY.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we can invest a ton of money, and LA has certainly, through sales tax, property tax, bonds, raising money, that, you know, there's money pouring into these cities, and often because citizens have voted that they want to do something, but they're not willing to say, okay, we'll have this affordable housing development in my neighborhood or in a shelter in my neighborhood. It often is met with just tremendous opposition.
Right. So you can say, okay, well, we're going to fund affordable housing construction. You can say we're going to fund shelters, but you have to, it has to go somewhere, right? And like we've seen in Washington, the mayor had an initiative to create, I think, both more shelter beds in total, but also to have more facilities. And her idea, which, you know, from a technocratic perspective makes a lot of sense, was that you should spread them evenly across the city rather than having some like den of social dysfunction somewhere. But it has been very challenging to get neighborhoods to agree that there should be these services in their city, to say nothing of getting neighborhoods to agree that just like in general, there should be apartments built.
That's right. And I think the city people who are in charge of that initiative would say that challenging is an understatement. But yeah, you have to cite affordable housing places, and there's a lot of opposition, and you have to cite shelters places. We need both temporary and affordable housing. And I think that one of the things communities are struggling with is like how, getting it right, also the balance. Like you don't want to spend all your time building shelters because it's a temporary solution. It doesn't really solve the problem. They fill up and then you need more.
Right.
You really have to invest in the development of affordable housing so that you can actually solve the problem.
Well, and this is important, right? Because I think a lot of people have a sort of mistaken impression that there is like a discrete population, right? Like the homeless, and that you maybe need to like shelter them someplace as a humanitarian gesture or as a toughness gesture, right? But the reality is that it's people exist on a sort of continuum of housing instability, right? And so if you have growing affordability problems, like systematic affordability problems, you will just have more people experiencing homelessness. And you need to address the sort of broad housing need on some level, even as you, you know, if there's people like experiencing acute problems, like you want to help them. But like the issue is that houses are expensive.
Yeah. And I think of sort of the homeless system as the sort of emergency room, right? Mm-hmm. People are in a crisis. They need help. They need a short-term place to stay. And the homeless system is there for them to work through that emergency. And then the broader affordable housing is really, you know, the healthcare system and making sure people get what they need in terms of their health, in terms of their housing needs. And, you know, if you look closely at the LA data, which I think is ground zero for homelessness in California, it's about 60,000 homeless people, about half of them are unsheltered. Mm-hmm. You can see that the city is starting to make some progress. They're doing the right things. They're investing in housing, but they've exited many people to housing more than they ever had before. But it's really a math problem. You need to exit more people than the people who are coming into homelessness to really reduce it. And that prevention piece is, I think, solved in the broader affordable housing system, but also there's some emergency prevention that we could do more on.
And, you know, LA, I mean, here we're eventually going to get back to Trump. But I think, you know, I think this is important because LA has become, I think, a real cautionary tale for progressive-minded people around housing issues precisely because LA has been willing to fund things, right? So they put a lot of money into homelessness services. They've also put a lot of money, this is a whole different topic, but it's related, into mass transit construction, right? So they've built out this incredible investments in LA Metro, right? So these are like the kinds of things that I think progressives would like to say if this, like, this is what we want to do for America, right? Like, we want to, like, build great things. But their transit ridership is down and their homelessness is up. And that's because you can't build houses for people, right? So if you could build apartment buildings near these metro lines, people would ride them and people would be able to afford them.
Yeah, and be a twofer.
Exactly. And your subsidies, right? Like, this is like low income people would much rather, right? You want a situation which, like, you can take a housing voucher, you can go on the rental market, you can find an apartment to live in, you maybe can ride the bus or ride the train if you can't afford a car. Like, that's the point of providing social services. But if you don't have like houses, then you get nothing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what you're describing is sort of, you know, ideal urban policy, which is transit-oriented development, developing housing, not only affordable, but all housing around metro stations.
Right. And so instead you've seen, they've started to have problems that are clearly in public view, right? A lot of, people on the streets, sort of encampments, trash problems, rat problems. And it's bad. It's a humanitarian tragedy. But it also undermines, I think, the whole sort of political paradigm.
Yeah, I really worry, actually, about that, the point you're raising, which is that I think a lot of the progressives up and down the West Coast have actually voted to pour money into this issue. And I think a lot of the leaders have focused on the right solutions, but the results aren't happening fast enough. And so I think when people are walking down the street and they still see people who are living on the street, going to the bathroom, living in a tent, they're frustrated, right? There's like both the compassion. Mm-hmm. But then there's also like, why is someone sleeping on my sidewalk?
Right.
Which is, you know, a practical concern.
Especially if you remember the ballot initiative just
that's
passed.
Right. You said, I voted. I now am paying more taxes. And I want this to be solved. I demand for this to be solved. And I worry a little bit about a tax revolt on that front, which is to say, like, if there isn't enough progress shown, that some of the generosity that progressives and compassionate people have shown, that that's going to decrease. And that's another thing that I think this sort of criminalization policing, it's very easy. I think it could be a very easy shift from, hey, we're doing housing-based solutions that are supported by the evidence, to, no, we just want these people to be gone and we're going to lock them up.
Yeah, let's take another break and then we're going to talk about this.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core, to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
So I think this is exactly the fear, right? We had previously, a virtuous circle where we had a new idea. We had implementation of the idea initially by Republicans, then continuing under Democrats. It cost money, but it was seen as cost effective and it was seen as working. And there was not a ton of public attention to homelessness. But when you had a story about it, I've written stories, I've read them in The New Yorker, The Atlantic. They were usually these like happy stories that like, oh, here's these good programs. So if you thought about it, it would be to say, well, my city should do this too. If you were like a smart mayor who wanted to have a good reputation, you would look at this stuff and say, oh, we can do that too. And you could make the case at the ballot box for, well, we should fund this because we have ideas that really work and people want to be humane. And it's an interesting mix because it's a, you know, sort of human welfare issue, but it's also a public nuisance issue. So if there's a solution that is humane but also resolves the nuisance, like people want to attack it. But then you get the sort of sliding downhill, right? If people feel like, well, we've spent a lot of money on this, but it's getting worse, that's when you get into, it seemed to me we had this new White House report that was like, well, part of the problem is that, you know, life might be too cushy and we've got to call out the cops.
Yeah. I mean, I think the White House report says quite a few things. One of them is, you know, one of them which I agree with is that homelessness is related to the housing market,
yes,
right? So that's an important point that I think not everyone actually takes home. I think a lot of people, you know, when I'm on airplanes and people ask me what I do for a living and I tell them, well, I study homelessness and solutions to homelessness, and then I get an earful of, you know, what they think are the solutions. Housing isn't usually one of them.
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, I think there is this like sort of disconnect around, you know, what are the fundamental drivers of homelessness? So I really do appreciate in the White House report that there is this focus on the housing market. Mm-hmm. But there's also this idea that, well, people, the weather is good in California. And also, you know, if shelters are really nice, then people are going to become homeless. I don't think that's true. And I don't think the data really bear it out. And I think, you know, when you think about the housing market, we need real broader solutions. And one of them is more housing subsidies. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is completely under the purview of the administration to propose more housing assistance. And like you said earlier, there hasn't been any administration or Congress that it's actually really fully funded,
right,
and invested in housing. So that's one of the things the president could do, which is provide more housing assistance and propose that to Congress.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's been interesting but frustrating to me as somebody who's written about zoning and land use issues for a long time to see the Trump administration both pick up these points about supply constraints and regulation, but also use it almost exclusively as a reason to not do affordability programs rather than as a way to like try to change the land use practices.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an all of the above. So, you know, we obviously need to, you know, there is some room for regulatory reform, I think. You know, exclusionary zoning is not a good thing for affordable housing development. If you can't build an apartment, if it's not legal, then you can't solve homelessness.
Right.
So that is a big part of it. I think the fear when there aren't any specifics, that deregulation is just rhetoric. And I think the fear is that, you know, there's going to be gone wild, the housing market, deregulate the housing market, no tenant protections, no anti-discrimination ordinances, all of those things that actually help decrease homelessness. I think that's the real fear. So
right,
we have to know more about, like, what does deregulation mean? You know, there are a lot of things that we could be doing around land use and zoning, and I think probably you and I would agree on those things. But I think the other thing is when we're talking about really poor people, we're not only talking about land use and zoning and regulatory reform, we're also talking about housing assistance.
Right. Well, and also the proximate zoning problem is directly related to the assistance, right? That it's, you know, you have programs to build affordable housing that both need more money and they need greater ease actually locating the projects.
That's right. And if you have a market that is producing more housing because of land use and zoning reforms, you can stretch your subsidy dollars further, right? So that makes the housing assistance more valuable.
Right. But you do see, I mean, we had Jenny Schutz on the show, and, you know, there are more and less expensive markets in America, but there's no market in America where low-income people at the bottom end of the labor market are able to afford houses without subsidy and assistance. It's just like everything else, healthcare, you know, college, high school, right? Like you have to have services for people who are in the low wage market. But so what about the idea of criminalization? Because I think this is where a lot of people, when they pull out of the sort of like happy Wonkland story, this is where people's heads start going that like, I don't want to see this tent in this public space, this guy sleeping on this bench, like, can't the cops do something about this?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me first start by just defining sort of what I mean by criminalization.
That's a good idea.
Right. So criminalization of homelessness is usually thought of as behaviors that you and I do at home, right? So sleeping, sitting, resting, eating, going to the bathroom, all of those behaviors people who experience homelessness have to do outside. Mm-hmm. They have to do in public spaces. And that's really outlawing those behaviors. So people are doing, you know, engaging those activities, sleeping on the street, sheltering themselves in tents because they have nowhere else to go. And often what happens, and this is actually on the rise in communities across the country, is that one way to address it, which doesn't resolve the issue, but one way to address that is to have the police issue citations, arrest people, put them in jail, and really criminalize those activities. Mm-hmm. And the courts recently have ruled that it's actually illegal to do that. Mm-hmm. So there is a recent case, Martin versus Boise, that found that it's cruel and unusual punishment to say if you have people who are homeless and you don't have any shelter or you don't have affordable housing, that you can't arrest them for being poor,
right,
or for being homeless. And I think that is going to be interesting to watch. As a recent case, I think it's being appealed. There's some hope that the Supreme Court will take it up. Mm-hmm. In fact, the LA County Board of Supervisors just signed on to it to actually urge the Supreme Court to take it on because they want to move towards a little bit more criminalization.
Right.
And I think there's actually really good examples of the criminal justice system working in collaboration with housing and homeless providers. So we work closely in Denver with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless and the Mental Health Center of Denver. And they have a program there which focuses on people who are chronically homeless and who are cycling in and out of jail. You know, they're living on the street, they're getting in trouble, there's a lot of nuisance crimes, they're panhandling, they may be publicly drinking, and the police are kind of cycling them in and out of those emergency systems. And this program actually says, okay, when you get arrested, we're going to offer you supportive housing. And what we're finding is that there's really high take-up rates if you can find people. And then there are really high rates of housing stability. And that, you know, the correction system, police actually like it because they are like, great, there's something for us to offer and something to do. And, you know, just scaling those programs, there's actually a program very similar in LA called Just in Reach. The problem is we just don't have the scale. And that is a lot about developing those supportive housing units.
Right. And so this is sort of the idea of, you know, there's a difference between saying, okay, like you can't be doing this, so here's what like we want you to do, and like just, well, you can't be doing this.
That's right.
Like it's you're too poor and that's illegal, right? So I guess if you have a city that does not have like acute systemic like affordability problems, right? Then this seems like something you should be able to do, right? I mean, I don't know that much about the housing market in Boise, but it seems pretty cheap, right? And so then you should be able to say there, okay, look, we have like chronic cases, people with serious problems, people who we are running through the jail system, which is costly, not really what police want to be doing with their time. So like what do they need to invest in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think for those, special populations, which I just want to underline that they're a small share mm-hmm. of the homeless population, that they should be doing what cities like Denver are doing, which is investing in supportive housing, using Housing First to help people come in off the streets, and then engaging them in voluntary services. Mm-hmm. I think that takes money, it takes investment, it takes a little bit of time, and it takes political leadership to make the right choices.
Mm-hmm. And do we see, has the current administration done anything useful with regard to these kinds of services and policies? I've been a little confused by the sudden spike in interest here from President Trump. What's actually going on?
Yeah, I don't think we know yet. I think that, there is some anticipation that there may be some recommendations from the Trump administration. I think there are a lot of concerns and worries that things that work like Housing First and supportive housing will be ignored, and the evidence will be ignored, and that things like policing and criminalization, which we know from history doesn't really work, will be taken up.
Right. It sounds like the president, at least personally, is inclined to sort of recycle what I remember from when I was a kid, sort of Giuliani era. If you just kind of get tough on people, I don't know what exactly the thinking is.
Yeah, if you get tough on people, we have more people in jail and prison.
Right. Or, in some ways, realistically, maybe you just even push them into some other neighborhood.
That's right.
Right, that you don't care about
some
as much.
Some other bridge or, moving on down the road. And then eventually people may come back, or that becomes a problem in some other hotspot area.
Right. And you just kind of cycle around and you don't have anybody. Because some of this, right, is you ideally want to have all your different services sort of at their highest and best uses, right? There are problems that only the police can handle, right? And you want them doing that work.
That's right.
Not hassling people who need a place to sleep, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think people, the police themselves don't want to be spending their time doing that. And I think we want the police actually policing criminals and making sure we are living in safe communities.
Okay, so if you were to just do dream world, federal policy, right? What do we do? You do
Universal housing vouchers.
Universal housing vouchers. So that's this is take Section 8, give it an entitlement program structure.
Yeah, that's right. Only about 1 in 5 people who are eligible for housing vouchers actually get them. Mm-hmm. So we know there's really long lines at housing authorities across the country, and 80% of people who qualify don't get it. So yeah, a universal housing program would be the best prevention.
Some of the presidential candidates have proposed that.
That is right. And there's some pretty bold plans. There's both a mix of adopting universal housing vouchers as well as doing something similar through a renter's credit.
Mm-hmm, right. So that's so is Kamala Harris has
and
this
Booker.
Structured as and Booker as a renter tax credit. And
Castro has a little bit of both.
Yeah. And did somebody else do vouchers? I don't remember.
It's hard to keep track. I will say it's the first time in my lifetime where the presidential candidates are talking about housing and are sharing bold proposals. Uh-huh, so that is super exciting. I never thought I would say, I'm having trouble keeping track of all of these proposals. So that's just a good problem
sure.
to have.
An exciting time to be alive. Anything else that you would like to see from a federal approach?
I would like to see more investment in homelessness prevention. So, mm-hmm. Universal housing vouchers actually would take care of it. I think that's a political, that would be really exciting.
Sure.
Absent that, we need investment in, broader affordable housing programs, National Housing Trust Fund, making sure we have enough production, preservation, but also that we are testing out strategies for homelessness and eviction prevention. Mm-hmm. So there isn't enough money, I think, and enough knowledge actually in this area. We know a little bit about how to offer emergency assistance. We know that if we give people cash, that they will not end up homeless.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Sure.
I think the challenge is trying to figure out in the big pool of people who are at risk. who actually is going to need help. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of vulnerable people out there who are paying too much for rent. You know, they're paying 40, 50, 60, sometimes 70 or 80% of their mm-hmm. incomes towards rent. That means that leaves them really vulnerable to homelessness. It also means they're, you know, giving up other critical needs, healthcare, food. And so, you know, really figuring out how to target prevention resources mm-hmm. and also preventing eviction, which, you know, is a really big issue as well.
Yeah. So is there anything on the sort of regulatory tenant protection front that you think like really works? Is like a like what are the really strong ideas on that front? Because I mean, I know a lot of people read Matthew Desmond's book and they like get fired
Great
up
book.
About this.
Yep.
But then it's like, well, like, what are you going to do, right? Because it's like the rule can't be like, well, nobody is ever going to be evicted if they don't pay their rent. I think obviously, right? So then the question is like, well, what kind of protection can you put on that like actually makes sense? And in particular, something I think people are not always fully cognizant of, but you don't want to make it impossible for people who need a new place to live to get a lease, right? That if you create a situation where the tenant protections are so strong that somebody with a spotty income history can't get a place to live in the first place, like that's not going to really help.
Yeah, I mean, and it certainly makes it landlords think twice about renting right. to lower income people. I mean, so it is a tricky balance. In thinking about some of the work that's going on as a result of Matt Desmond's book and really focusing on evictions, guaranteeing legal assistance and legal counsel in eviction courts, providing some emergency assistance in those courts. Mm-hmm. You know, you may be able to negotiate with a landlord and pay that back rent or mm-hmm. at least prevent the eviction filing so when the person moves on to the next apartment that they don't have that history, which mm-hmm. might preclude them because it's a little bit of a death spiral there. And
right.
like if you have an eviction history and you're going to find an apartment, most landlords are thinking, well, I'm not going to rent to this person.
Right.
And that kind of makes business sense, right?
Right.
And so, you know, there's a lot of mediation going on in, I think, eviction courts and housing courts. I think the question is how do we swim further upstream and really try to figure out how to actually even prevent people from falling behind, mm-hmm. how to help people who are really vulnerable. And I think there's some interesting work going on around using data to actually look at where are the places where eviction filings are coming from mm-hmm. and using that kind of geography to target resources, cash assistance. Because like mm-hmm. I said, it's like this huge pool of people who are at risk and figuring out who, you know, you can inoculate the whole group and prevent it,
sure.
which is a universal housing voucher strategy.
Right.
I'm all for that.
Uh-huh.
Or you can try to use a more precision instrument. And
right.
like the data are not that robust. And so it's very difficult. And not only that, but, you know, emergency situations are often unpredictable,
sure.
right? You know, you have like a health problem, your partner leaves you, or, you know, there's a domestic violence situation. A lot of those things happen or on an emergency basis. And so trying to figure out how to target people using data, and I think that's around like where are the evictions coming from? Where are people entering shelter from? There's some actually pretty good evidence that using geographic targeting could be one way to do that.
Yeah, so that raises actually the last thing I wanted to ask is like, what do we know about? Obviously, it's a big country; every story is unique. But like, what are the main sorts of life events that happen that lead people into a situation where they're experiencing homelessness? Like, what's a kind of typical, you know, problem scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of reasons why mm-hmm. people become homeless, and particularly emergency situations. So a lot, you know, losing a job, mm-hmm. A health problem or a mm-hmm. medical emergency, or even just really falling behind on medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
Breaking up of family, so often two, you know, income households, that is a much stronger from the perspective of being mm-hmm. able to pay the rent than, you know, a one person household. So all of those things certainly contribute to domestic violence and people fleeing domestic violence mm-hmm. and living in untenable situations. That's a part of the story. I mean, it's really hard to really understand like the immediate event that mm-hmm. precipitated, because often where we collect our data is in the shelter, but people when they are experiencing housing stability, shelter is actually the last place that they end up.
Right.
You know, they don't go first to the emergency shelter. They, like, go to their sister's house and they stay there on the couch for a while. They may, try to find a short-term motel. So there's, like, lots of stops along the way in terms of housing instability before you get to that last resort of coming into an emergency shelter.
Right. So it's sort of, it's difficult to track exactly what the original, like, destabilization is, because you won't see people just, like, moving out of a two-bedroom apartment, like, right into the shelter.
Yeah, not usually. And I mean, I think it's just really important to note that if you're poor in America, you face, you know, just so many challenges, persistent mm-hmm. challenges that may, I may be able to handle as mm-hmm. a higher income person, but that could turn, really spiral for people who are persistently poor. Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of middle class people underestimate the amount of routine housing instability in low income families, right?
Yeah, so they do.
Even if there is no span of homelessness in there, it's just a typical situation is to be moving a lot.
That's right.
Right.
That is absolutely
and
right.
And so then there's, like, a lot of cracks that you might fall into.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of good data on that. I mean, we know, the measures of housing insecurity that we look at rent cost burden, so mm-hmm. people paying too much for the rent. Mm-hmm. We look at overcrowding. We look at housing quality. But, like, the sort of doubling up, the moving around, we don't have great data. And often that data actually is not for one person. So
yes.
You're not following someone over time. You're just, like, taking different snapshots. So really understanding those patterns of residential instability are not entirely clear.
Right, right. Okay, so thank you very much. Before I let you go, I always like to ask people, what should I have asked you about? What did we miss here that's important?
Yeah, so I would just say, this. Let me get on my soapbox for just 1 minute, which
Let's
is to
it.
Say I think that people underestimate the power of housing and housing stability, housing opportunities. You know, it really is inextricably linked to your opportunities in life, right? So mm-hmm. if you don't have stable housing, it's really hard to go to school every day, do your homework, and do well in school. It's hard to keep a job. It's hard to, move up. And so housing stability is really a prerequisite for economic mobility. And so I really want to encourage people to think about housing as an investment in a longer-term strategy where you really want to help people access opportunity.
All right. Mary Cunningham, Urban Institute, thank you so much. Everybody who's listening, we are doing a survey here at the Vox Media Podcast Network. If you go to voxmedia.com/podsurvey, we would love to hear what you have to say about us and all of our many shows here. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks again, Mary. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And The Weeds will return on Tuesday.